Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Talking about death and dying is difficult. It becomes exponentially more difficult when death is near, and decisions need to be made during a very emotional and stressful time. Planning for end-of-life care is about deciding now how you want to be cared for or treated medically during the final hours or days of your life, or in the case of terminal illness, how that care should proceed if the illness progresses and you're unable to convey your wishes. The best way to plan for end of life is to have the difficult conversations before they are medically necessary. It is the topic of the first segment of today's program. Our guest today, Dr. Vipul Bhatia, who is WellSpan Health Medical Director and Continuing Care Services. Dr. Bhatia, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
Also joining us is Roberta Geidner, who is a Horizon Advanced Care Planning Coordinator with WellSpan Health. Ms. Geidner, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott.
And attorney Mac Brillhart. And Mr. Brillhart, we're glad to see you this morning.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, this is a topic that I know a lot of people have questions about. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Bhatia, what is advanced care planning and what makes it important for everyone?
So advanced care planning is planning for what kind of treatments that you would prefer towards the end of life, and planning and having those discussions with your family members and loved ones earlier in life when you're not towards that end of life juncture. So it can start at any age. We can do it when we are 18. We can do it when we are in our 30s. We can do it when we are in our 60s. Or towards the very end. The most important thing is that you have to determine what your preferences are for your life, how you wish to be treated when you are towards the end of life. And the other important decision that you have to make is, if you are not able to speak for yourself, who is the person that you trust who could make decisions for you or speak for yourself when you are not able to? And that is something that is... all this combined is what we can say is advanced care planning. Mm-hmm. Now, as you grow old and as you age, the kind of decisions that you have to make may be a little more complex compared to when you are younger. But the idea is that if you start when you're younger and you don't, the decision making is not that complex, it becomes easier, relatively easier for you when you're older because you've started way earlier.
Is there an ideal age to do this? You said starting at maybe even 18, but is there an ideal age?
Every age is ideal, Scott.
Okay, why do you say that?
Well, because at age 18, if you're perfectly healthy, the only thing you're going to decide is, if I got in a serious car accident or hiking accident and I was near the end of my life, I want my family to know what I would want. And if it goes badly, then I want to be an organ donor or not. But then if you're 35 and you've got heart disease or pulmonary disease, you may have a different answer to that question. If you're 65, you're going to have a different answer. If you're 90, then you're looking at old age and frailty. You may be getting dementia. So you really want your family to know what you would want so they can represent you the best. And at every age, our life changes. So for me, at age 67, my husband died at age 51. After that, I've had probably 6 different powers of attorney as I've moved, as my life has changed, as I now have a new partner. So I'd have to change my durable power of attorney for healthcare every time my life changes.
Yeah, there will have to be some flexibility because of changes in your life. Not only new partners, not only where you live, but new diagnosis. Maybe there's something you're dealing with later in life that you weren't earlier in life, correct?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And that's why we say this can change. We have 6 Ds that we talk about of when you should review. The first D is decade birthday. So every decade birthday, just pull out your living will and your durable power of attorney and make sure they still represent what you want. The death of a loved one. When my husband died at age 51, that situation with his family was very conflictual. And so I learned a lot about what I don't want to have happen when I die with the family that's surrounding me. If you get diagnosed with a serious illness or diagnosed with a disability, that's another time to look at it because your decisions will change. If you get discharged from the hospital, now you've got a serious health event that's happened. Do your wishes change? They may not, but you should revisit it. And then as one staff person told me after I did a presentation, she said, you know, I recently got divorced and I'd forgot that my ex is still my durable power of attorney for healthcare. I sure don't want that person pulling the plug on me, so I need to change my document.
Yeah, so, we'll talk with Matt Verhart about that in just a moment.
But, so we put divorce as one of our Ds. So yeah. It's listening, looking at those six Ds, when do I review? Those are the perfect times.
Yeah, and it's, I would say that it's, people say that they delay it, that we can do it later.
There's another D, you know. Stay away from that D.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we say that it's too early until it's too late. So,
but I have to admit that if my 18-year-old came into the room and said, I want to talk about end-of-life care, I'd be a little concerned about why my 18-year-old was thinking about that.
But perhaps she is listening to your show and is encouraged and motivated about to have that discussion. And if she would come to you, you should be encouraging that conversation and not delay that.
Or like my 19-year-old stepson got in a terrible car accident and was near death several times. He didn't have any documents. His parents weren't automatically allowed to make the decisions for him. And I think Mac can step in here and say, what happens if you don't have these documents and you're in a serious situation? Who can speak for you and who can't?
Well, before we address that, Mac Brohart, let's talk about the legal documents that people need to know, whether they require an attorney, just what?
So they don't. Of course, there's some thought out there that because of these documents and their significance, that it's good to have a professional review them with you and explain them to you. But there's absolutely no requirement in Pennsylvania that an attorney be involved. In fact, folks can write their own powers of attorney, living wills, even your own last will and testament yourself. There's also no required form. And so although there is a statute in place that has a suggestion as to what the legislature prefers, someone could draw up on their own, by their own hand, on their own paper, their own healthcare power of attorney and living will. Mm. So no lawyer needed, no prescribed requirement as to the form.
All right, so just list the documents for me that people should be aware of.
Sure. So the general term we use is healthcare power of attorney, which would be a non-end-of-life document that nominates a person to make non-end-of-life healthcare decisions for you. So in the event you're hospitalized, you're injured, you are assigning decision-making responsibility for healthcare decisions to someone in the event that you are unable to make them for yourself. Then there's an array of end-of-life documents. That area has sort of exploded over the last 10 years, whether that be, and they're all under the cloak of advanced directives. So that could be a living will. It could be what's called a POLST in Pennsylvania, which is a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment.
DNR, as many people do not resuscitate.
Exactly. We also see the document called Five Wishes. And so there's a number of end-of-life documents that have differences between them, but they all exist.
Is there one place where someone could go to learn about all this? I mean, I know you have, we're going to talk about a project that WellSpan has with the York County Bar Association, but is there one place, does it exist outside of York County?
Oh, yes. I mean, these documents are nationwide.
Right. I knew that. But
so you go to the internet and you put in advanced directive and you'll get several different websites. If you go to wellspan.org/horizon planning, we have four or five different pages that talk about all the aspects of advanced care planning. And you can order free documents. If you go to UPMC's website, Penn Medicine's website, any one of our health systems, just type in advanced care planning or advanced directives, and they'll have a section on their website.
You know, one of the issues, challenges, hurdles that you hear about often is, you know, because we're still in the stage of talking about people talking about this, that seems to be one of the main hurdles to get over, is that there are many people that don't want to talk about it for whatever reason. They may think when we use the example of 18 or 19-year-old, They're indestructible. Right. They think nothing bad is ever going to happen.
Absolutely.
But people think that way their whole lives up until maybe they're 50 or so and start needing some additional medical care. So that's one thing. But there are other people who believe that maybe a little bit superstitious that if we talk about this, I have all of these plans, it's going to happen. How do you get people to talk about it?
And that's where I think this creating awareness that we're doing through this show and a lot of other activity that we are doing in our communities is to encourage people and break that taboo about what you just said, that, hey, if we talk about it, it's going to come on. That's not the case. We plan for everything else in our lives. Why not plan for what kind of treatment you would want and not want towards end of life? And as I said earlier, the most important decision one can make right now is to identify that person who would be able to talk for on their behalf and have that important discussion with that person so that and impart that courage for them to make that right decision towards the end. So if all the listeners, if they can do that today, think about what they would want towards end of life and who would be the person that would make that decision for them and talk to that person about their preferences, about their wishes. So when that moment comes, that individual is not playing a guessing game, is actually acting on the words that they have heard from the person for whom they're making the decision for.
Well, and I'm going to add, Mac and Vipul, that it should be more than one person, because sometimes that one person may be in the same accident with us.
Correct.
May not be available, may be camping in northern Canada with no cell phone service, and then you don't have anybody who can represent you. So always have two, possibly three people. You can have a primary, but have a backup to that person
and
in case they're
that,
not available.
Excuse me, we get that question routinely, which is, how many should I name? And the answer is as many as you want. You can name 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You can name a primary agent, and you can name dual successor agents as a team. And so we're always encouraging folks to think in the contingency angle of naming multiple agents. And the question becomes, can I name more than one person? You can under the statute, but that question arises as to what if the two disagree?
That was my next question. I mean, 2, 3, 4, 5, the more voices that are coming into it, there would seem like there'd be potential for, well, mom didn't want this. Yes, mom did. Okay, mom has it written down, but did she really want that? That there would be disagreement.
And that's a too many cooks in the kitchen
right,
question.
Exactly.
So obviously, if you have an even numbered class of people and you have the ability for deadlock, if you have an odd number, you do not. The statute allows for the majority to rule, as you would expect. But that's a difficult question for an attorney, which is, should I name my two children or should I name one and then the other? And that's not a lawyer question. That's a client question. Do they get along? Do they understand your wishes? Have you educated them about you what you want?
So you're saying if there is more than one person named an odd number, Mac, you're advocating democracy in this.
I am always, Scott.
Well, and that's where we think having a conversation is more important than the documents, really, Scott. That if you sit down over a cup of coffee and really go through what your wishes are and share among family members so your children are telling you what they want in case something happens to them before anything happens to you. That conversation helps people to understand and helps to reduce the conflict and particularly helps to reduce the moral distress that families feel when they're making those decisions and they're just not sure because they've never talked to each other about it. Mm.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Join us for APM Reports on Education with a set of three new hour-long documentaries. They'll examine how predictive analytics are reshaping the college experience, how schools teach reading, and a look at efforts for children in unstable housing to do well in school. Join us for APM Reports on Education next week, Monday through Wednesday at 9 a.m. on WITF. We'll be here instead of WITF's Smart Talk. That's next Monday through Wednesday at 9 a.m. a.m. By the way, today's program is part of WITF's Transforming Health Project. A deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare. Check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Capital Blue Cross, and WellSpan Health. And yes, that disclaimer, just to let everyone know, full disclosure, that WellSpan Health is a sponsor of the program. Joining us today, Dr. Vipul Bhatia, who is WellSpan Health's Medical Director in Continuing Care Services, Roberta Geidner, Horizon Advanced Care Planning Coordinator with WellSpan, and attorney Mac Brillhart. Give us a call. We're talking about advanced directives and end-of-life care. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Corey in Harrisburg. Corey, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning. This is a topic that's really close to my heart because I was assigned to make the decisions for my mom at the end of her life. And we did everything that you said. We had a document. We had conversations about it. But I failed at the moment when I needed to decide. We were visiting her, and her heart stopped, and bells went off, and 10 people came running. They kicked me and my brother out of the room. A few seconds later, they opened the door and said, "What do you want us to do?" And I, at that moment, my little brother was crying, and it was just chaos and stress and pressure. And I said, "Do everything," which was she wanted DNR. So I was wondering, how often does that happen? And also, is there a better preparation we should have done? As we were talking in a conversation, it would seem very easy for her wishes. Yes, I will do that. But as far as the moment, you know, of the complete despair and grief and loss and chaos that's happening to be, and I don't want to say that I didn't have the courage. I think I had too much love to let her go. And they did bring her back, and she did live several more weeks. But so if we could just talk about that for a moment, I'd appreciate it.
Corey, I'm glad you called in with your experience because my guess is it probably happens more often than we think that thank you very much, and that's a hard situation, what he just described.
Yes, absolutely. And Corey, I really thank you for calling in and describing what you went through. And I'll say from the experience that, yes, it does happen. And Scott, you're absolutely right. It does happen more often than we think it does. But I think over time, as we are creating awareness through programs like these and other activities, that if there is more public awareness, not only the courage that the loved ones and the family members like Corey need, it'll also have an understanding of the implications that it can have if that is not done.
But let me ask this question. Corey mentioned that there was a do not resuscitate order. Why didn't the doctors know that?
So there is a difference. So what we document in the living wills about what kind of wishes we would want towards end of life, it can be override any time when the patients are admitted to the hospital. Now, I'm not saying that happens every time, but that is done in discussion with the patient as well as the patient's loved ones. So giving you a scenario. So let's say I have a living will and I say that I would not want any type of resuscitation when I'm terminal and there is no hope, but I may get admitted into the hospital for something simple. And at that time, I'm not terminal, so that living will does not come into play. But all of a sudden, when I'm in the hospital, my heart stops suddenly. So at that moment of crisis, that living will was not in play because my condition was not terminal, and it just happened so suddenly. And that is the moment I'm assuming may have happened with Corey's mom, as he described it.
Let me ask this. Today, there have been a lot of changes in how people are cared for, the kind of communication that we use, the technology that we use. Something that we hear about very often today, electronic records. Say a loved one has a family doctor, but they're traveling and or rush to the hospital for an emergency. Would that doctor in that that new hospital where the person was admitted or is being treated, would they have any way of knowing that this person has a living will or has orders that have directives?
So if your family doctor is part of a health system that is all on one electronic health record, wherever they provide the document, the rest of the health system can see it. But for instance, if I'm traveling and I travel to Philadelphia, my local doctor at WellSpan has it, but it's not going to be anywhere in Philadelphia. So we suggest to people, put a copy in your car, in your glove compartment. Put a copy in your suitcase for when you travel so that you have the document readily available. WellSpan is on an electronic health record called Epic, and it has the majority of the market share in the United States. So if there's any other system that is on Epic, they can see that you have a document and who your primary care provider is or who your hospital is, and they can call and then get that document sent to them. They can't read the document, but they can see that it's available. So that's one of the values of being on the same system and having records that can be read across the country.
Mac, Dr. Bonnick, just hold on. I had a question for Mac then, and that raises the question. Once you have all these documents, you've had the conversation, you've done all this, where should they be placed?
And I think that's as important as what the documents say. I mean, we have folks come in, we prepare their medical advance directives, and they put them in a safe deposit box at a bank, which is closed on the weekends. They don't tell their children where they're located. And so having these documents prepared and not knowing where they're located or having them be inaccessible in an emergency situation does virtually nothing. And so before we started this joint venture with WellSpan, the York County Bar Association, we would encourage clients to give their medical documentation to their primary care physician. But even as short as 5-10 years ago, that paper document given to that person's doctor went right into a physical file. It wasn't an electronic record. And so this initiative between WellSpan and the Bar Association is meant to encourage estate attorneys, as they meet with their clients, to ask for consent to have the documents transmitted securely and electronically to WellSpan, where they are entered into Epic with that person's medical information.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Bonnick, and that raises the question, this project that we're talking about with WellSpan, and as Barbara mentioned, health systems across the region, across the state, across the country. But you've entered into a partnership, I guess I can call it a partnership, with the York County Bar Association. Why?
So just to overcome the issues that were addressed by my fellow guests, an individual completes their advanced directives, have the discussions with their primary care physician, but that document either stays in the primary care physician's office or in their own home. It doesn't get to the electronic health record. And similarly, if they complete it with their attorney, and despite attorney's guidance to give it to their primary care physician or the health system, it doesn't get to the health system. Ultimately, at the moment of crisis, when these decisions are to be made about end of life care, most of the time they're made in the hospital setting, in the acute care setting, and if those documents that were completed in the community are not available to the hospital team members, physicians, nurses, and other team members taking care of the individual, all that good work and all that effort that has gone into place to get those documents ready can be undone by one small step not being completed. So that's why we approached our independent physicians and independent skilled nursing facilities in our communities to utilize the process that exists to transmit those documents to Epic so that it becomes part of their electronic health record. And similarly, on that lines, we also approached our Bar Association. We were very grateful for them to be raising hand. It's not because we are WellSpan and they need to work with WellSpan. It's a community initiative. So if there are clients that come to our local attorney's offices and they say, like, hey, I don't go to WellSpan Hospital, I go to a different hospital, So the message that we have for them through our attorneys is that, hey, whichever health system you go to, make sure that health system, their electronic health record, has your copy of these documents. But if you happen to go to WellSpan, we have a process which makes it easier. Are you okay with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. And I think that whether you're affiliated with UPMC or Penn Medicine, we hope that the listeners, even from those organizations, are listening. And the idea would be that this spreads across all health providers.
Mm-hmm. We've gotten several questions from listeners' emails along these lines. What can you do when you are alone and don't have anyone to appoint as your advocate or power of attorney?
Well, I tell people, look at close friends, look at church members. I know that Mac was talking on the way up here that he's provided assistance to some of his clients to be their advocate for end of life. There are people in the community that act as guardians to help people who are isolated and alone. We hope that doesn't happen for many people. And I met with a couple of people last week, and they were pulling ex-wives and ex-husbands, you know, people that they're still very close with because they don't have anyone currently that can represent them. After my husband died, I used my two best friends as my powers of attorney, because those were the people that were closest to me.
Cut.
And I think, you know, Scott, this last will and testament, living will, they sound so much the same. There's a durable power of attorney for finance, as well as a durable
right.
power of attorney for healthcare. People get very, very confused about those four documents. They think their durable power of attorney for finance, that signs their checks and pays their bills, can also make healthcare decisions for them, and they can't unless they're also named on that separate document. So part of this education is just, what are these documents? What's the difference between them? How do I find them? What do I do with them? And what is intubation anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's one of the questions you have to be able to answer.
Laura says that we have put my mother's directives on her cell phone so that those documents are with her wherever she is. Now, you know, again, we have technology today that allows you to do things like that, actually, rather than even carrying paper documents. Unfortunately, I have to say that sometimes you lose your cell phone. So nothing is foolproof, but it's a good idea as well, because most people do have their cell phones with them all the time. Let's take another phone call from Steve in Lancaster. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment with regard to the selection of an agent. I've worked for many years as a hospital chaplain, and my spiritual care department was the kind of ground zero for advanced directives within the hospital. And one of the things that that we did was we did we completed a lot of advanced directives with patients who came in without the document, but they then wanted to do it. And I would always caution the patient as they were making that decision that they needed to be real careful as to who they chose as their agent, that it would be somebody that would and could fulfill their wishes. And so I cautioned them that maybe the spouse was not the person to select because they were the potentially the most closely emotionally related to the patient. And if it came down to making a decision about life or death, they may crumble and fold there at the end and not fulfill the patient's wishes. And so that was just a comment I wanted to make, that agent is a real significant individual, and they have to be able to fulfill your wishes even if it means the end of your life.
Thank you, Steve, for the comments and some good information, Mac.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to add to that might assist listeners is the decision, when you set forth that if you're permanently unconscious or you're in a terminal state and you do not want heroic measures, you don't want artificial means, you have the ability under the document to say, even though I've named my wife as my agent, my wife must follow my instruction or my wife may override my instruction. So if I had concern personally that my wife knew what I wanted, but she would be grief-stricken and not be able to comply with my wishes, I have the right to, if, for lack of a better term, tie my wife's hands and say, you will ultimately be restricted in your decision, and you must follow my instruction. And that's one way to deal with our concern about the ability of loved ones to follow our instructions if we think they may struggle with that.
What happens, though, you know, we've talked about that this is a good conversation to have at any age, but someone who maybe is suffering from dementia and wants to make changes, you know, and I know the legal, there's legal terminology about that, but that you question whether the loved one or the person that you're making these decisions for is of sound mind and body, I guess that's the terminology, that they're making a good decision for themselves. What about a situation like that?
So as I'm meeting with people, largely elderly people, that's a call that attorneys have to make in that setting, which is to oftentimes meet with the person alone, ask family members to leave the room, and try to, not that I claim to be a physician by any means, but try to assess, are they appreciating what the document means? Are they appreciating the change? Have they been nudged by someone, you know, prior to coming in? And that's a serious responsibility in the event, and I've had this happen dozens of times, that I've had to look at someone and say, I'm not comfortable with you changing your will or your power of attorney. I'm not going to be the lawyer to do that for you. And they have the right to go down the street to another attorney and try the next person out, but that can ultimately cause that person to have to go to court.
And similarly, in these kind of scenarios play out in a healthcare setting as well. So if any of the healthcare team member that is assisting that individual have that discussion or make those decisions about end of life, and if there is any slightest of concern about the decision-making capacity, there are processes in place that we can follow, steps we can follow to get to that point where we're making the right call.
You've provided a lot of great information here this morning. I have a caller who said that they're very interested in having the conversation with their family now, and they want to know where they can go, and I think he's talking about online, where they can get information on what to do.
I'll say that their local resources, so you can go to a website called yourlifeyourwishes.com that is again done through York County Healthy Coalition. There is WellSpan website, wellspan.org/horizon planning. It'll give you some information. If you are interested in getting a resource kit that can help you prepare for that initial conversation, there's an excellent website through Institute of Healthcare Improvement. It's called the Conversation Project. So if you Google the Conversation Project, you should be able to download that kit.
I want to thank all three of you, Dr. Badia, Roberta Geithner, and Attorney Mac Brillhart. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott, very much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Listen tomorrow for Finding Your Family's Military Roots. We know there are a lot of people out there that nowadays are, you know, whether it's Ancestry, 23andMe, that are sending in DNA samples, learning about their family history, and often they are very curious about their military history, and we have a resource right here in Central Pennsylvania with the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center. We'll be talking about how you can go about doing that on tomorrow's program. You can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Journalist Jackie Lydon has seen mental illness, war, the destruction caused by terrorism, and fashion in a unique way up close. She's written and reported on all those diverse topics and much more throughout her 40-year career at NPR and writing for other publications like The Washington Post and The Atlantic. Her 1999 memoir, Daughter of the Queen of Sheba, describes growing up with her bipolar mother. Jackie Lydon appears at Lancaster-based Hippocampus Magazine's Conference for Creative Nonfiction Writers at the Marriott in Lancaster tomorrow afternoon. That conference is being held throughout the weekend. Jackie Lydon, welcome to the program.
Steve, it is such an honor and pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I just talked about the conference itself. Hippocamp, a conference for creative nonfiction writers. It's for writers who want to write true stories, whether as journalist or writing their memoirs, which you've done both. You have done both of these things. What's your main message to the people who will be attending that conference?
Well, my main message is to be accurate. So did I just get your first name wrong?
That's one of the keys.
Absolutely. I think that fiction, that nonfiction has a lot to learn from journalism, and that journalism has a lot to learn from nonfiction. And what I mean by that is that in both cases, you're trying to take the situation around you and make it sensible. And particularly in memoir and nonfiction, your job is to make the insensible sensible. I think that all these years, you know, you spoke about all the different venues of stories that I've done over the years, and it's not just showing up at those stories. It's the multiplicity of countless edits that helps an observer, a writer, make a pass through those stories. And that's what I want to talk to the audience about, because we're living in a time in which truth is definitely getting hammered and challenged. And so what the two approaches share is an adherence to finding that truth and then making a narrative from it.
And something you just touched on, that the world we live in today is different than just a few years ago. I think of fiction writing or reading a novel, reading a fiction short story. I mean, it's an escape. It's a form of entertainment. We forget about real life, our own lives, for a few hours. But with the issues that we're facing in this country and around the world today, it would seem as though fact-based nonfiction is as important as ever. Would you agree?
Well, I would push back on what you just said a little bit. It made me think almost immediately of a story I once did in Iran, in which a university professor was using fiction to challenge autocratic thinking. She was using examples from Alice in Wonderland, where Dorothy questions the Queen. She was using Tom Sawyer, where Tom speaks truth to power. I think fiction can absolutely be more than escapist. I mean, look at Toni Morrison and how she held, you know, the old phrases, the mirror up to society and the lens on the world. It can also be escapist, and there's nothing, and that's good. Our minds need that too. I don't think it has to be quite that binary. I think what I would say is that whatever the story, I want to come out more illumined than I was when I went in. And I also think that we need to stand together to defend fact, that it is the basis of reportage. I think, you know, fiction gets a different kind of a pass, but I think that nonfiction doesn't. I think that nonfiction absolutely has to get facts just as right as any piece of journalism.
Well, let's talk about journalism. And I'm going to talk specifically about your career in just a few minutes, but here's a broad question. How do you see journalism today?
Well, that's a little bit like saying, how do I see the ocean today? I mean, there's lots of different,
that's right.
different pools and tides and bays and estuaries which it flows. I think it is a challenging, obviously it is a really, really challenging time now that we live in a 24/7 news cycle. I think that is one of the biggest changes that I've seen in just the last few years since I've been at NPR. The kinds of time that people have to tell stories now, if you're at all involved in daily news, you likely know yourself, you know, don't you find you're standing under much more of a shower of information now than you were, you know, previously?
Oh, I feel like there's a different bomb show every day.
And because there is, you know, and it's partly the White House, of course, but it's partly the speed of information now, and that we have more of a global look at news. And then, but there are ways to go deeper that we didn't have before. Your own podcast, you know, would evidence that. So I think that journalism is a little more daunting in some ways now. I'm really, really encouraged by how many young people want to get into it. I'm glad. We need them. We desperately need them. We also need the nonfiction writers who I think can come at things in a longer format, can come at things outside some of journalism's sometimes rather restrictive boundaries, and certainly it's often restrictive deadlines. And, you know, I was thinking a lot about truth because I do want to talk about it at this conference. And I was looking for a really good definition because I thought I don't want to come up with just my own. You want to hear?
Sure.
So this is from Britannica. Truth in metaphysics and the philosophy of language, the property of sentences, assertions, beliefs, thoughts, or propositions that are said in ordinary discourse to agree with the facts or to state what is the case. Truth is the aim of belief. Falsity is a fault. People need the truth about the world in order to thrive. Truth is important. Now, this was written, you know, quite some time ago. And I love that phrase, truth is the aim of belief, falsity is a fault. It is because it really poisons our thinking. And at NPR, we used to say that we wanted to catch people in the act of thinking. And that is something that I think writers and journalists need to follow and to pursue, because we've really become so fixated on the grab soundbite. There was a lot of criticism about that, you know, CNN's hosting of the latest Democratic primary debate. And I think that if you're a writer and you're a really good reporter, you want to have your observing lens in front of you, but you want to have your synthesization and your fact-checking back in your brain. And so you really have to do these things simultaneously. And think about what you're going to do beforehand, and think about the means by which you ask questions. What is the art of your interview and the purpose of it? So these are the kinds of things I want to talk to people about at the conference.
Well, a memoir is supposed to be truth. One of the reasons that, you know, I know that they wanted to have you speak at the Hippocamp this weekend is because you have a vast experience, not only as a journalist reporting from overseas for NPR, but you wrote your memoir called Growing Up with the Queen of Sheba. It was about growing up with your mother who lived with mental illness. She was bipolar, or as it was probably called at the time, manic depressive. Mental illness can be a hard way to live, but from the book, you eventually embraced what your mother brought to you. In what way?
Well, you know, Scott, to this day, my siblings might have a different view of that sense of embrace. But I'll tell you one thing: it hasn't gone away. So either you learn to counterbalance and learn to yield to the fact that this reality is not going to be one that responds to your directives, or you're really going to have, you know, many, many miserable hours, not that we haven't had them. I felt when I wrote Daughter of the Queen of Sheba, Scott, that on the page, I could have a conversation with this altered reality who was my mother, that in normal life I couldn't have any more than you could have with someone who's intoxicated or hallucinating. And it was a way for me to make that narrative pass I was talking about a little while ago through the material of our lives. And it was interesting because by the time I wrote Daughter of the Queen of Sheba, you know, I was at least in my mid-30s, heading for my late-30s, and I was on the border with between Kuwait and Iraq, and a Palestinian man was being kicked out of Kuwait, and he complained to me that now he would lose all his family history. And at that moment, for whatever reason, Scott, I just felt like that is me. I'm going to lose all my family history if I don't go back and write things down. And I just had this kind of flash sensation that my interiority needed to be documented, which is not the impulse of a journalist. That is very, very, very much the realm of nonfiction and memoir. And I think I was as surprised as, you know, as anyone.
What did you learn from your mother?
Oh, so many things. She's still with us. We're going to celebrate her 90th this winter. I'm writing a new memoir called Tell Me Something Good. I never dreamed I'd write another family memoir. It just became necessary, just like the last one did. I think a number of things. Her huge sense of imagination is very much mine. I had my first newspaper when I was 7 years old. It was a piece of typing paper, a one sheet, and I drew the boxes on it and filled in the stories. And she was always my most fascinating character. And then we would distribute that on the Lakeside Lane where we still live. I called it the family news. Also, it was great.
It is great.
And a certain kind of purpose and indefatigability. Even now, you know, old age is not for the faint of heart. It is rugged. She has had other physical assaults. Fortunately, she does not suffer from dementia, which would just be such a cruelty on all these years, after all these years of mental illness. And when I say that, I mean at least not, you know, that is not our biggest challenge. She has a lot of mobility issues. But I watch her then as now, just refusing to give up. And that's a quality that I really share. And to find a lot of joy in life, which is something I do pride in myself and my family members. And, you know, we've tried to be a team. We sisters who support her. Our mother lives at home. That's part of what my new book is about. It's called Tell Me Something Good. And the family can get pretty fractious around what is the right way to go. But the fact of the matter is that we're still here. And I'm not sure. And in fact, in 2003, I was in Iraq when my mom had the second brain assault. It's called normal pressure hydrocephalus. And she had brain surgery. I never thought we'd get here. We were told she had a couple years. So now it's, 17 years later and 16 years later. And we are. So That is a message that I think, again, is the province of memoir.
Your book, Growing Up with the Queen of Sheba, is considered a memoir classic. That it is, you know, it's 20 years old, but it is considered a memoir classic. And the title itself, your mother declared herself the Queen of Sheba, correct?
Yes, she did, Scott. When I was about 12, it was the first, my mother had already vanished into the mental hospital, and she was taken there by my stepfather, who was a very, very prominent doctor in our town. And he was a cold and remote, controlling and very abusive figure. And so the idea, we lived in this small town in a small, he had a small hospital. And so the idea that he would have disappeared her with no explanation was, of course, terrifying. And it was left to my grandmother, who, you know, had only a fourth grade education, to explain. I remember, and I apologize for this word in advance, your ma's in the nut house. And obviously that was like a trap door to a young person's imagination. And our mother came home after 2 weeks, and she seemed very fragile. And I was already really interested in the world and reading a book about the Aztecs and the Mayans in South America, when there was this knock on my bedroom door, and it was my mother, and she had wrapped herself in the bed sheets. We were home alone, and she had placed this tiara that was our plaything on her head and announced herself and said, "I am the Queen of Sheba, and I bequeath to each of my three daughters the country, for you, Jackie, Mesopotamia, for your sisters, Carthage and Thebes." And so, honestly, I never saw that particular incarnation of her again, but yet I grew up to become a Middle East correspondent, and that was another linkage that made it important for me to think about the ways that the mind can act and the inner dialogues that we have throughout our lives.
We only have about a minute left, and there's so much more we could talk about with Jackie Lydon. Ms. Lydon, you were a foreign correspondent for NPR, but it was here at home that you had one of your most memorable experiences. You were the first NPR correspondent to report from New York on 9/11. I only have about 60 seconds left. What was that like?
Overwhelming. Surreal. I had not expected to be our first reporter on the air. I was looking out the window of my Brooklyn loft, which I still have, and I couldn't actually see anything because it was September and the leaves were on the trees. But in the wintertime, that view, I called the Twin Towers my campaniles. And I was calling Washington to let them know that I was available in New York, that I was home. And they immediately put me on Morning Edition and asked me what had happened. And, you know, this is with an audience of millions, of course. And I said, well, it is a crystalline morning, and we can only think that this is not an accident. What else could I say? But then, right. You know, I was able to go out.
Jackie Leiden will be in Lancaster speaking tomorrow at the Hippo Camp, the conference this week for nonfiction writers. Jackie Leiden, welcome to Central Pennsylvania this weekend. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.